Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's now hour number two with my very special guest, Wiramu Bayliss. And we're talking about raising a child who has fetal alcohol syndrome and the challenges regarding that. And indeed, we're kind of branching out into a lot of different topics surrounding simply raising children with cognitive disabilities and all of that kind of thing. So, Wiramu, welcome back. Now, when we went on break before, you said you had a number of other things that you wanted to outline, so proceed.
I've talked about the type of dispower or disempowerment that we've had, if I could use that term, in relation to being home for life parents, the scenarios that we face comparatively to being child, youth and family caregivers in the past and migrating to this home for life situation. One of the big impacts on our family, and I outlined it previously, is the consents that we have to go through or to get just to make the day-to-day decisions for this child in our care. And one of the things I've advocated recently to members of Parliament, in fact, I had a meeting with our two MPs on Tuesday, was to discuss possible changes to legislation that would make it easier on one side to make those decisions independent of needing that parental consent, or that biological parental consent, especially when they're in the best interest of the child, and to be able to make the freedom of those decisions without having to have to worry about it becoming a matter for the courts.
Could you be more specific? Like, who were these MPs, and specifically what kind of amendments were you proposing?
I met with Hamilton West MP Tim McIndoe and Hamilton East MP David Bennett on Tuesday. And what I put before them is a rather long letter that I had composed over some time. I probably in the end emailed about 50 MPs version 10 of the document I originally started hammering out one night on my iPad. And one of those was how I believe we should at some point in our law be able to fully terminate the biological parental rights of a child to a child, especially in situations where we've got multiple children from the same parents in state care and there's no long-term prospect of them being returned to that family. This is the situation that we're in. The biological mother is obviously legally incapable of parenting the child. The biological father is, by law, not going to have the child in his custody. And so, yet now, under our current law, their rights are protected. And so while the Care of Children Act, in one of its prime in one of its principal early on sections, the child's concerns are paramount, or the child's best interests are paramount, yet it's the parents, the biological parents' rights that are protected. And because of that, they're able to manipulate the lives of the families who actually look after them day to day. What we've talked about as it's sort of a compromise, because that wasn't something that they were willing to look at putting to the minister, was increasing the rights of families such as ours to be able to not have to worry about domestic travel being a consent issue, the school that she goes to being a consent issue, or the fact that we go to church winding up in the courts. You know, being able to be manipulated in that way, of just being able to live life, you know, without the worry of a court scenario hanging over our heads. okay, the wider issue of access may end up being a court issue in the future again. But, you know, being able to go on holiday down the South Island without having to ring up people who are disengaged from the raising of this child, either by choice or by law, you know, is a freedom that we want. And that's not currently available to us in law, nor is it really available to us in any of the amendments that have been, or the law that's being proposed in this vulnerable children bill that's in the House now.
My perspective, I mean, I've interviewed a number of people who have had children in SIFS care, and on the negative side of the spectrum, and there's lots of these kind of cases, what occurs to me is that good parents wind up getting their children taken off them, whereas bad parents wind up having their children kept and indeed under their control. And it's almost like there's actually an agenda to destroy children's lives using the law as a weapon, rather than being able to enrich people's lives using the law as a tool.
Yep, absolutely. I totally understand the negativity that is out there, with especially with child, youth, and family. And when I use the term, I grew up in the system. My mum was a social worker. For my formative years as a young boy, growing up, until she retired when I was 23. I went to school with a lot of the kids on her caseload, and quite frankly, they were humbugs. But a lot of them also had gone from place to place to place and had very unsettled formative years. And I think if they had some form of stability, whether it was with their biological family or whether it was with another family that was able to look after them long term, I think if they had some kind of stability, then the issues facing them later on, and in some cases still facing them now, probably would have been negated. I worked with a young father whose wife actually attempted to do some damage to their child, and the child was taken from them and placed into SIPS care. I saw him go through the process. Him and his wife then at the time go through the process of restoration of trust between them and the child, and the state getting to a point where that child was actually put back into their care. Now, those types of scenarios are not the ones I'm concerned about, because there are those families who have momentary blips, they have the problems, they want to deal with them, and they're going to get the child back. There are those who... and I spoke about this grandfather earlier on. You know, there are those families who have false accusations thrown at them, and SIPS in a very reactive way just comes in and yanks the kid. It's not. I don't think that's in the best interest. I remember accompanying my mum. I was 16 years of age at the time. I remember accompanying my mother to a report that there was a child, there was a child at least that she knew of. In this house where there were drug deals going down, likely drug use being done at the time, and there were four police cars, herself being the duty social worker and two others, and I was her driver. I drove her to the location. The house was completely sealed up, and they basically shut all the windows, shut all the doors. And what I couldn't really believe was they had taped the windows, basically so there was no vent, there was no air flow through the windows at all. And they had been bonging it up and doping it up. And in one of the side rooms that was completely filled with smoke were these two babies. One was already blue. And the other one you know, with, yeah, it's the reason why as a teenager and as, even as an adult, I've never drunk and never done drugs, not only because of my religious beliefs. I've seen what it can do firsthand, and I never wanted to be involved in that kind of stuff, especially if it can harm another human being. But I've never seen my mum as devastated that night as you know, it was crazy. And she reflected on it a number of times. And so, you know, there are people who, you know, even in that situation, under our current law, which didn't exist at that time, under our current law, those biological parents would still retain the controlling interest in those children's lives, even under SIPS care. And I think most of us would agree that under those extreme circumstances, they shouldn't have any rights to that child. You know, they've basically shot themselves in the foot, and they might as well shoot themselves in the head. And I make no apologies if that sounds harsh, but you know, you've got to stop being selfish at some point when you've had a hand in bringing another child into the world. And you know, I've made my fair share of selfish decisions in my life, and you know, I'm man enough to admit it. But I think the best decision I could make, if I'm not going to take responsibility for that little life that I helped create, then let somebody do it under full law and let that child be adopted. You know, and cool, you know, move on. But don't let them languish in a system that really isn't going to help them. The only reason that we believe our daughter has progressed as much as she has, and I don't make an apology for calling her my daughter, is because we've invested the time into her. And, you know, I don't consider myself a saint by any means, but for goodness sakes, if those biological parents aren't going to take responsibility for her, it's not the state's job. It's, you know, let somebody else do it. And that currently is an impossible situation because, again, the power rests with the biologicals. We can't go to the court and say, look, she's been under our roof for 7 years. Let us adopt her. The biologicals still have to give consent. And I'm certainly not advocating a return to the dark old days of adoption, when babies were whisked away and, you know, all that kind of stuff. For me personally, it's important that she knows her history. It's important that she knows her story. And where that's possible to give it, we're certainly going to give it. We know that she has three half-siblings. There's a fourth possibly that even the mother's pretty foggy on. She's not even 100% sure that there is an older child. There's a suspicion that there is. We don't know. Just 2 weeks ago, we rang up the biological mum on a phone that we've specifically designated for contact purposes. She told us that she was in Wellington, but couldn't tell us exactly where because she wasn't sure. And so, you know, that's just to give you an idea of the kind of people we deal with. And I really hate to say this, but we're saved from a lot of these potential court issues by the fact that we're not dealing with the brightest match in the box. You know, and unfortunately, there are others in the same situation we are who are dealing with more manipulative people, and have been doing it for a lot longer than we have. So what I advocated and what I... And to some degree, what I'm still advocating is that at some point in our law, New Zealand should be able to, or people should be able to have their parental rights terminated and that child be placed up for adoption. And the measure, I guess, for that would need to be high. I guess one of the measures would be that there's no long-term prospect for this child to go back to their biological family, whether that's parents or grandparents or an uncle, an auntie, you know, somebody who's reasonably capable of being a parent to that child.
What you're talking about here is about just introducing something that the law doesn't currently have. Reason, logic, and compassion.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, the child needs to be thought of. And more than the grown-up. And we talked about it before, that the grown-up, you know, you need to realize, talk about patience, I need to be realized that I'm the grown-up and she's the child. And more often than not, she's a child being a child, you know, who wasn't, you know, stubborn and answered back to their parents at some point. And again, seven-year-old with intellectual disability and other cognitive difficulties, she's still learning right from wrong. And its rudiments, you know, that crossing the street without looking left, without looking right, could be hazardous to her health, is something she's still working on at 7 years old. So that, I mean, that may give a bit more of an idea of the type of difficulties that we're working with to try and help her just be safe. Stranger danger is still a foreign concept. And just to give you an example, I said we spent a few weeks over in the States. On our layover in Los Angeles, she actually went and talked to this man and his son over by the gate where we were going to board our plane. And so I was over there, our plane was there, it was getting, you know, prepped for the next flight. And so we looked at the plane, and that's the plane we're going to get on. And she was still talking to this guy, and he looked vaguely familiar to me. I recognized him from somewhere. I just, famous, just couldn't picture where from. And the face in my head and the name just weren't meshing.
It wasn't Jimmy Savile, was it?
No, it wasn't Jimmy Savile.
I'm just joking.
No. But 48 hours later, I was looking at my iPad and looking at Facebook, and this guy's face appeared, and one of my friends had linked the thing. It was Eddie Izzard, and he comes up. He actually came up to me when we arrived in Las Vegas, and says to me, "That girl is so beautiful. She's so loving. She's so friendly. You look after that girl, and she's going to have a tremendous life." And, you know, that was so complimentary from a stranger. And yet at the same time, in the back of my head, I'm going, you could have been an axe murderer, and she would have had the same conversation with you, and you would have had malicious intent. And so, you know, while that situation was good, she'd go up to anybody in the park and just be so trusting and so open that not really realizing the potential, you know, the stranger danger aspect, that, you know, don't go up to strangers, don't accept candy from strangers kind of thing. And so those simple things are things that we're trying to instill in her, that most parents don't have to struggle with. But I guess it's pretty common with those who do have to deal with children with disabilities or...
Well, it's about decision-making and reasoning processes that simply don't exist. They're just not there. And so, you know, you can sometimes, I mean, I've got mates and their child's really, really perceptive and what have you. And they, I don't know, it's almost like the kids know who's a good person and who's not by instinct. It's really, really odd. Like, I'll see somebody who looks kind of dodgy, and the child will look at them and go, that guy looks kind of dodgy. You know, like they're kind of like right up there. Whereas I don't think if you don't have that perception, you can wind up getting into, as you say, a lot of trouble with that stranger danger element. Which means more or less constant supervision, which is a lot of, shall we say, intense responsibility on the people who are raising that, something that's probably not within the realm of possibility for somebody who has an enormous addiction problem and somebody who's a convicted child sex offender.
Yeah. And we went out of our way a couple of years ago to actually go and meet the biological father. We arranged the time to meet in his town, and we went and spent the weekend down there, stayed with some friends of ours in the town. And it was just myself, my wife, met up with him and his partner. No, and they had two kids, and have two kids. And we just said, no kids, you know, Ellie's going to stay where she is, and our girl's going to stay where she is, and your kids can go wherever. And well, the grown-ups will just meet. And so, you know, we sat down and met with him. It was the first time we'd met with him. And we discussed, you know, we'd like to adopt her. We'd like to have your blessing to do it. We'll maintain contact, you know, as she grows. And the conversation from his side of things was, well, you know, she's mine, she's mine, she's mine, she's mine, she's mine, she's mine. It actually reminded me of that Finding Nemo, the seagulls, you know, mine, 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 mine. But yet at that time it was, what, 6 years she'd been on Earth, and you hadn't tried to make contact, despite, you know, his, what did he say, that he had never, he didn't know she was in care, that she, you know, she should meet me, blah, blah, blah. It was all about him. And in a very funny way, even though that the mother and this father have actually never been together since the one night stand, really, how similar they are. And you know, it's funny that both their names start with M, but the commonality between them and how they act in terms of the child being a possession was really surprising to me. And again, both of them very possessive in terms of mine, 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 yet neither of them are really capable of ownership. And when I say ownership, I mean responsibility for this child. And it's in those scenarios, you know, and I guess a few more tougher tests to determine whether or not their parental rights at some point should be removed and we should be allowed to adopt this child.
The term slippery slope comes to mind. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm a conspiracy theorist. You know, I'm quite proud of it. And
wouldn't have guessed with your intro.
Yeah. And what I've found out over a number of years of study and interviewing basically copious quantities of people who've dealt with SIFS care and things of that nature is that there's an agenda to destroy the family unit. Right, a global agenda to destroy the family unit. And this has become really, really powerful, I think. We've now got, like, what, 50%+ divorce rate? And you have a look at the stats on young boys that don't have their father in their life for all or most of their life, and they're, like, something like 7 times more likely to get a criminal conviction. And you have, and then on the other side of the fence, you have CPS in the United States, Child Protective Services, where children are 9 times more likely to be sexually abused within Child Protective Services care. And when we look at legislation and having the state have the ability to make decisions for families rather than those families being able to make those decisions for themselves, it means that the state becomes all powerful. Now, it reminds me of so many examples throughout history where the dear leader of the country becomes a de facto parent for children. They get forcibly put into government indoctrination programs called public schools. And if anything, what it does is it prevents parents from having control over how their children are raised and how their thinking functions and what have you happen, because it becomes down to the point where you can't earn enough money in enough hours of the day so that you can spend a quantitative amount of time with your child, teaching them everything they need to know on a daily basis in order to get through life. So you're forced, therefore, in order to give your child into the care of the state for a certain number of hours a day. And in so doing, the state has direct access to your child's mind for the majority of their life, more or less. And I think this is actually quite dangerous. But that said, when we're dealing with a case like yours, I think you're probably right. There should be some kind of apparatus or framework by which a reasonable decision can be made in order to take destructive, possessive parents out of the equation, perhaps, and leave them with people who have proven themselves time and time again to be really good for the child. I mean, it's like, what decision has to be made, who is going to be putting this legislation into place? And the thing is, that aside, what's actually best for the child, and who gets to decide that if not the parents? Yep. You know, that's the tipping point. That's the troubled waters in which we are taking this vessel into. And myself, knowing that there's some form of almost like a child psych warfare going on in high schools and whatnot, this is particularly poignant in the United States, where children are being asked to give surveys on what their parents do at home and then give it to their teachers so that they can put it on record. What kind of drugs do mummy and daddy have in the cupboard? How many guns do they have? You know, these kind of things. The state really has no right or anything to do with your business at home. But at the same time, when we've got this kind of mediation process going on, it's actually untenable and unsustainable, this situation that you're suffering through right now. You can't go on like this forever, can you? And that's probably the reason why you actually want to do something about it. That's probably the reason why you want to change the legislation around this, so that other families that might be in a similar situation to you actually have a legal framework with which to resolve these issues in a very reasonable and perfectly safe kind of way, without the abuse of the state or the abuse of their parents revisited on the child.
Yep. See, we have less protections now as home for life parents than we did as SIF caregivers. As a SIF caregiver, we had a social worker assigned to the child. We also had a support social worker assigned to us as a couple who were there to support us. If the mother, for example, who was the most consistent one, in fact, she was the only one until we underwent home for life proceedings in 2010, wanted a supervised access visit, she'd go to the SIPS office or contact the social worker, however she did it, and they would contact us, arrange a time, they would arrange a place, a neutral location, usually the Salvation Army center in town. They would arrange a neutral person to oversee the access, so we could go, you know, we could go off for an hour, and she'd be supervised, she'd be safe. And that person who they would assign would report back to Child, Youth and Family about what happened at the visit. You know, I'm not, for us, again, there were, you know, we got a stipend from Child, Youth and Family, not relevant.
Hold on, what's a stipend? I don't know.
We got an allowance from Child, Youth and Family.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Just to cover board and, you know, basic necessities and things like that. So we weren't paid for it. Basically, they paid us a board, an allowance. And all caregivers get it.
Hmm. you weren't given a lump sum when you first took on the child?
No. We got nothing. We bought a bed. In fact, we actually had, in the hopes of having our own children, we had a cot stowed away, which we assembled, and we had a lot of things already in place because we wanted to be parents. But because of my, I guess you could say, my excess baggage, that wasn't happening. So things we had in place already were really good. I mean, we used the quarterly clothing allowance that Child, Youth and Family gave us. We sent it to my mother-in-law in America because the seasons were, they're coming out of winter when we're going into summer. The sales were going on, and so we got copious amounts of clothes that would last you a lot longer than stuff you can buy at the warehouse and for a lot more value for money from the States. Got sent over, and, Grandma being grandma was excited just to send stuff anyway. And so we utilized the funds that we got from them in her best interests. But if things went to court, again, we were covered. We didn't have to think about, how are we going to pay for this? How are we going to deal with the legal aid or the legal cases? Because Child, Youth and Family basically were the ones that were being taken to court instead of us. Whereas now, as Home for Life parents, it's us.
Sounds more like life imprisonment.
Well, look, this scenario last year with when the father tried to get supervised access visits, he actually served us, not Child, Youth and Family, because we're the ones with custody. But Child, Youth and Family wouldn't even come to the party. She's not our child, basically. She's not under us. She's not one of our children in the system. And so that's, that's something that we had to deal with. Well, the biological parents both qualify for legal aid. They get this stuff sorted under legal aid. We basically funded ourselves, which was the case. Our Hamilton West MP, Tim McIndoe, advocated on our behalf, and we managed to get something out of Child, Youth and Family because of historical cock-ups.
Would you say that the deck is kind of stacked against you in this case?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Because, again, any legal matters are against us. It's us personally as opposed to, previously as caregivers, as Child, Youth and Family caregivers. Custody is with the chief, under the chief executive, under the umbrella of the chief executive. And so any service that is done is done against Child, Youth and Family and their unlimited checkbook, as opposed to, we live life on a budget, just like any other family does.
Well, what occurs to me there is that the deck is stacked against one person on one side of the spectrum and it's stacked against the other on the other side of the spectrum. It used to be the stack was it was stacked against the parents, and now it's stacked against you.
And for being a parent to a child whose parents can't do their job. For us let's put it this way. If you look at it just from a financial perspective, we get an unsupported child benefit every week for this girl. And should we adopt her, which we hope to do this year with the consent of the mother, we'll lose that. We don't care. It's financially, it's not the issue. Money is not the issue for us. It's the full protection of law and also the full rights and the full privileges and the ability to exercise our rights as parents, because we're held fully responsible for what happens to this child, but we don't have any of the rights and protections that parents get. Again, just the fact that a grown adult has to ask let's put it this way, a grown, relatively mature adult has to ask the permission of a younger, not so mature, drug addict and a convicted sex offender on one side, you know, the permission to go to Wellington or to go up north for the week, or, you know, go down south for a week. You know, we have to just get those types of silly things.
Well, you know, I mean, nothing makes for better, more streamlined decision making than having to have the approval stamp from drug addicts and sex offenders. You know, I mean, I can't imagine a more perfect system.
Well, here's another situation. We were asked last year if we would be interested in taking in another child. This is from a friend whose sister-in-law had a baby. The mum is in and out of the loony bin, but the mental health facility here adjacent to Waikato Hospital. So if anybody knows Waikato Hospital, they know exactly what I'm talking about. It's called the Henry Bennett Center. And the father is in and out of prison. In fact, I think he's there now, for beating up the mother repeatedly. And the mum keeps going back. And so this little baby was taken into care a matter of hours after birth. Not the first child in care. I think was the fourth. My darling's over there. Let's call it third child. And again, this is the kind of situation that doesn't exist in our neighbour's country. You know, in Australia, if you've got multiple children that go into care, bang, you lose all rights.
They try and support you while pregnant.
I mean, they try and support you while you're pregnant. If the problem can be solved, cool. If not, there is a termination point. Okay? But it's very quick. So if you've got a child that's taken off you at birth and it's not your first situation like that, and you know, that's it. Done. You know, and the same in other cases. I mean, if you want to cite the states, and you know, whether you like the states or not is irrelevant. The fact that the same scenario exists, this is not your first party, this is not your first child taken off you, and you're not doing anything to sort your stuff out, gone. That child is gone, and it's adopted. They become adoptable, and they're given at least a chance to have a foundation start. You know. Now, what happens after that, you know, you talked about divorce rates, stuff's going to happen and families are going to dissipate. But you try your best, and it's up to the couples to make it work. But at least the child is given an opportunity that if they're just left in that scenario, if they're left in that I guess, never-ending cycle, if the biological parents aren't capable of breaking that cycle for them, then maybe the child should be put into another position and be given an opportunity that they probably would never have had if things stayed where they were.
Well, I mean, voluntary participation I'm actually a hell of a lot more in favor of, where people will actually step up and say, I'll protect this child, I'll provide for this child, I've got X amount of qualifications, I've got such and such a stable family home. You know, it seems pretty straightforward, right? Mm-hmm. But again, what occurs to me here is that if you're doing the right thing and what have you, they try to make your life harder, and if you're doing the wrong thing, they're just trying to make your life easier. You know, I mean, like, this is one of those kind of things that happens off to the side. However, it happens a hell of a lot more often than people might think. And in so doing, it's actually doing a huge quantity of damage to children in a society, which means that when they grow up, they will grow up as damaged adults. And I would like to see the statistics on this, but I'm not. This is just my postulation, based upon this. Whether or not children that are in state care and whatnot are far more likely to wind up going to jail. All right, because I've seen so many cases where children are ripped away from their families. It's called breaking the bond. As the Jesuit said, you give me a child until the age of 7 and I will give you the adult, or words to that effect. If you are transitioning around to various different environments, different state homes and things of that nature, during those formative years, you permanently destroy that child's ability, in many cases, to be a functioning adult. And once you become an adult, nobody else is any longer responsible for you. You have to be responsible for yourself. And if you were raised irresponsibly, well, guess what's going to happen? You're going to wind up getting frickin' incarcerated. And who are you going to be incarcerated with? A whole bunch of people that are in the exact same situation. And the cycle continues, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and it's in part the patience shown by the caregivers to be in there for the long haul, and that's something that when the first social worker we dealt with, that's something that we said that we're in for the long haul, and that's why we're still here, 7 years on, 6-7 years on, and that's. Despite the different situations and the different trials that my wife and I have been through, the one thing that we've both remained constant with, is her best interests. It's always been about her, and we've made bad calls along the way, but it's we're human, But there's one thing about admitting your mistakes. And making changes to get yourselves back into a position where you're focused, you're determined, you're dedicated. And that's the situation that we've found ourselves in. And with her diagnosis recently of intellectual disability, I've been looking for full-time work, for probably close to 2 years or more now, so that both of us can work towards goals of getting out of debt and, making some moves that are going to help benefit our family in the long run. And we actually came out of the meeting deciding that that's actually not in the best interests of our family. And so when I say I work as a life coach, I've started to work from home, so that if I'm needed at our daughter's school, or there's other, like, for example, medical appointments that have been a lot lately. There have been a lot of them lately. Or there's support that she needs at school. There's other things that need happening around home. I'm available. I can tailor my schedule to that. But having us both work in full-time scenarios is just not in her best interest and in our best interest at the time. Sure, financially it would benefit us greatly. It would be awesome. But like I said about the financial support that we got from Child, Youth and Family and the benefit that we get from Work and Income now, that's not the driving force behind what I do and what we do. The money, cool, would help, but we need to be there to support her, and that's the full focus of what we want to do, and to make sure that she's got that foundation that she needs.
Well, it seems that there's an old saying, the most important thing you can spend on your children is time.
Time.
And this is another part. Raising kids has gotten harder and harder and harder. It's always been hard, all right? In fact, it would probably, to a degree, it was probably harder back in the day because people had maybe 10 times as much fertility as we do today, because we've all got all these artificial sweeteners in the food supply and GMO food and fluoride in the water and blah, 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 blah. All of these things are just taking fertility. It's dropping like a stone, more or less, and there's statistics to prove all of this. Now, the problem here is back in the day, like when my father had our family, I'm the youngest of five. He was able to support and raise five children on one income, and we were able to take holidays in the summer and things of that nature. That's not frickin' possible anymore. All right, unless you're I don't know, perhaps born into privilege, it's actually becoming statistically unlikely and even more unlikely by the day to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I look back on a time prior to having our young girl in our house. My wife and I were probably pulling in somewhere around the region of 130,000 combined income a year. And we were refused mortgages on more than one occasion. And this was before recession. This is before this land value issue. And, you know, quite gratefully so now, actually, I can look back on it and saying, blessing in disguise. But, you know, we're actually, you know, getting by on what my wife earns and what little I bring in just helps supplement that. I mean, we're able to put a little bit aside every now and then, and I've got friends who are coming up for the Ironman in Taupo this weekend, and it gives us a chance to go down and, you know, be the cheering squad and, you know, all these types of things. And, you know, every now and then we go have a weekend away, or even sometimes it's just going out as a family to a movie, or even just going to rent a movie and get a couple of little microwave bags of popcorn, and that's a treat, you know. So those little things are really cool to be able to do, and we don't need two full-time incomes to do that. But as you said, you know, the best thing I can invest into this little girl's time, and the best thing we can invest into this little girl is time. But I guess on the other side of it is, you know, no other success. This is another maxim that that I learned through church, and I really believe is that no other success can compensate for failure in the home.
I got another thing to tell you here. Firstly, about microwave popcorn. Did you know that Soviet Russia outlawed microwaves in the 70s, classified them as a public health risk?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Under occupied Finland or Norway, behind the Iron Curtain or something like that, they did a study on university students, and they were like, you know what, let's see what happens. Let's get 10 university students and let's give them microwave food every meal of the day. They had to stop it on like day 10 or 11 or something like that, because every single student was beginning to show signs of adult onset leukemia. So Russia went, yeah, let's ban them.
but they put nuclear reactors in their microwaves. We all know how Chernobyl worked out. But I guess I just talk in the wider variety in terms of treats. You know, get the whole fizzy drink business and all this stuff going on. For us, I put that in the category of treats, and those are, as you know, I guess the PC world has even overtaken Sesame Street, and Cookie Monster is not so much Cookie Monster anymore as it used to be, scoffing cookies, but
Broccoli, you know, Monster now.
Yeah, he's you know, cookies are a sometime food. And there are some treats which we have in our home, which, you know, for example, I might buy one big bottle of fizz every other week, and that lasts, you know, a few days. And so she gets to experience, you know, different things and different foods as well. Her lunchbox isn't stacked to the brim with preservative-laden food, and it's, you know, make her fresh sandwiches every day, and she has fruit and, you know, variety in her lunchbox. And so, and her dinners I make them here. In fact, tomorrow, just to give you an idea, tomorrow night I've got pumpkin, you know, little round pumpkins, which I'm hollowing out and going to put meat in them and bake them. And, you know, that's, so, you know, with lots of veggies and a bit of meat, and, you know, it's, I just try and experiment with it, and the idea is that she can scoop her food out of this whole pumpkin and eat the pumpkin as well. So fresh garden stuff, it's awesome. It's not hard to do, and really it's not expensive. I priced it out that this meal for the three of us is going to cost $12.
Yeah, well, that's pretty spot on.
Yeah. So, and it's all whole foods, hot, you know, broccoli and little bit of mincemeat and onions and spinach, but baked in this pumpkin. And So you got all your variety, and then I usually, you know, try and give her at least 2 or 3 bits of fruit in a day, and so she gets her 5+.
Hey, well, here's another bad piece of news for you. Did you know that because of industrial agriculture, there's supposed to be something like 50 trace elements that are available in the soil in order for food to actually develop the nutrients, properly?
Yeah.
There are now about 3 of, yeah, of those elements left in the soil because of intensive farming practices. And California recently did a study on this about the nutritional value of their fruit and vegetables and so on and so forth. And they amended the 5+ a day in California to 10+ a day.
I've kind of looked at the 5+ as it's at least 5+, but it's one of those things where the food pyramid's kind of gone upside down and left to right, and you know, I don't exactly hold on to the.
Here's another funny thing about the food pyramid. A nutritionist went to a cattle farmer in the United States, and he showed them the current FDA approved food pyramid, and he goes, "Does this look familiar to you?" And the farmer looks at it and he goes, "Yeah, that's about the same diet we give our cows when we fatten them up for the slaughter."
Yeah, it's crazy how much damage we're doing to ourselves when we just don't pay attention. I mean, to things. You know, I don't spend copious amounts of hours looking at the, you know, I guess the nutritional panel on the back of a product, and but I do, especially when we planted our own garden. We knew the soil was deficient in a number of things, and we know in general that one of the big minerals that we need is magnesium.
Mm. Yeah.
Which is very deficient in our soils.
And selenium too, deficient.
Selenium too. Mm. Funnily enough, those are some chemicals that we produce naturally in our own bodies. But in a child that's got developmental problems, issues, concerns that our girl has, those are the chemicals that help balance her out the most. And so those are the things that, while we don't give her a full-on multivitamin regime to help supplement it, we do provide her some form of, I guess, non-industrial strength vitamins, but ones that are going to help her at least supplement what she produces, I guess, boost what she produces a little more, but it's, you know, through natural supplements. One of the things that she does not produce, and this is common with fetal alcohol syndrome kids, is melatonin. And so we've found a supplement which we actually get from the States, which helps her just get over the barrier of not going to sleep, because it would be, having struggled early on, it wouldn't be uncommon for her to be awake now. And I mean, not sleepy awake, I mean full on awake. And so we know that about 5:30, 6 o'clock, she's starting to naturally feel tired, and 0.5 of a milligram is all we give her. The tablet is a 1 milligram chewable tablet, just like our old vitamin C tablets we used to chew on and suck on like lollies years ago. So we give her half of one of those a night. And it, you know, within a half an hour, she's snoring, asleep, and on average, about 10 hours sleep a night.
Probably a lot more effective and less damaging than giving her sleeping pills.
Exactly.
Which
some parents do. And the thing is, it's melatonin. The only ingredient in the pill is melatonin. Outside of the stuff that keeps it in the pill form, you know, and that's okay, because that's a natural biodegradable consumable anyway. But it's one of those things that just helps her get over the thing, that helps her body to grow and helps her body to develop. And I've got no problems with. I don't consider that in the same league as Ritalin. You know, I don't put that in the same league as Ritalin. It's not doing her body any harm. Like excess vitamin C, you get rid of it. You know, your body naturally disposes of excess vitamin C.
Interesting fact about vitamin C, it's the only medication, or rather treatment, that has no known toxic dose, which is not even true of water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you drink too much water, you can actually make yourself sick.
Yeah.
Or die.
Yeah. A study performed in the States where they gave several pounds of vitamin C directly infused into the bloodstream over a number of years with no noticeable side effects. I thought that was quite amazing.
No, I mean I have a multivitamin regime. I just take a one multivitamin a day. It helps me. I have regular medical checks just for my own sanity, and just to make sure that what I'm doing in terms of my diet, having come down from such a high place, is not doing me medically any harm. You know, it's quite a ways to come down, some 135 kilos, and if you do it wrong, it could cause you more damage than good. I didn't have any conditions prior to this weight loss starting, so I wasn't diabetic or even pre-diabetic. Didn't have any cholesterol or blood sugar issues. Basically, I was healthy. I was just extremely fat. In fact, I was in my own category of super morbid obesity. I felt really special. Not. And so, you know, just making sure that the supplements that we, well, the things that we don't get naturally from our fresh fruit and veg, are being provided for. And I have to say that, you know, whether you like multivitamins or not, for me, they're working. My bloods are where they should be, and all those important elements are where they should be.
There's an old saying, you can't argue with results.
No, you can't. And
it doesn't stop some people from trying, particularly medical doctors. You know, don't take that multivitamins. They don't do anything. Here, have this incredibly dangerous drug with 700 different side effects, including killing yourself and your family in the bathtub.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny talking to people about multivitamins, as I was the other day. I says, you just got to be careful about what multivitamin you do have. Some people's bodies absorb particular vitamins easier than others. We all know that we can't absorb more than a certain amount of VC a day. The body just naturally gets rid of it.
American GIs in Vietnam know exactly how much VC they weren't allowed to consume in a day.
Vitamin C, I should say, not Viet Cong.
Apparently napalm's good for the skin.
Boom.
Anyway,
moving on.
Yeah, we can come to a break now if you want to quickly finish your point, and we'll run off on that note, you know, on that high and freebie note, you know, ladies and gentlemen.
We went with that one, man. But no, it's just being careful. I mean, for us, it's about making sure that basically what we consume in our home isn't going to do us damage, and it's more important for our little one to make sure that she's got healthy food. She's drinking good milk. That, you know, and really, I don't care whether it's a light-proof bottle or not. Milk. It's from a cow, you know, as long as it's milk from a cow. Milk that we trust, it's not going to make you sick, you know, ultimately.
Allegedly. I've become lactose intolerant, which really sucks because I actually really did enjoy milk in my coffee back in the day, but now I have to have black coffee. Seriously, I get sick as a dog if I have milk. Unless it's actually fresh from the cow, hasn't been pasteurized, hasn't been homogenized, hasn't been, you know, like, basically what happens is pasteurization and homogenization, all it does is destroy all the possible nutrients that your body can get out of that milk in order to make sure that it's safe. So it's like drinking nothing.
we want to go visit my uncle's farm in Turangi so she can naturally see, you know, drink straight milk, because it's been a long time since I've done it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do agree. Some of the processing takes a lot of the good stuff out. Mm. And, you know, that whole, you know, why go buy a calcium-rich milk, you know, the yellow-top stuff at the shop, when you can just go get it straight from the cow and, like, it's got everything there, including the cream.
Yeah. That stuff is good. All right. We're going to go to break, and we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after that one with my very special guest, Wittamu Bayless. Back in the tick. Mm-hmm.